17 and 18 today, and then next 2 weeks from today, we'll be looking at 19 through 21, then we'll finish out the book of Judges. Now, as we've been going through Judges, you've noticed that each sermon I've preached has been from a chapter or a section of Judges, and that it has been about a particular character. It's been about somebody that God has called or raised up to be a judge. And that is not somebody that would decide court cases in the way that we think about a judge, but this would be somebody who God raised up to deliver his people. It was a response of God to the crying out of his people. Frequently throughout the book of Judges, we see that God's people would turn away from him, despite all the good things that he had done for them, and despite him being with them as they went to take over the promised land that they had been promised. The people very quickly turned away from God and turned back to their own false gods or the false gods of the people around them. They became ensnared by the people, these other nations. And these other nations then began to oppress Israel. And this would go on for a period of time. And finally, the Israelites would have enough and they'd remember, oh, hey, maybe we can do something about this. And so they would cry out to God. They'd call out to God and God would raise somebody up like Samson or Jephthah or whoever, Gideon, and that person would then be able to deliver the Israelites, and there would be peace in the land during their lifetime, and then after their death, the people would sadly turn away, back away from God very quickly. After the story of Samson, that cycle stops, and we have two longer stories in chapters 17 and 18 and 19 through 21 that show us just how chaotic things became in Israel. And the people were, they could never really find a way to be obedient to God in the short term, definitely weren't able to do that in the long term. And so the book is going to end on these two stories, but I think that these two stories give us a lot to think about. They give us a lot to consider. And this morning I'm going to read chapter 17, then I'll explain chapter 18 in part of the sermon. It's a different kind of a story. And it's going to involve some idolatry, and it's going to involve some ridiculous behavior, and that it's there to show us something specific. So Judges chapter 17, verse 1. There was a man of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, the 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse, and also spoke it in my ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it. And his mother said, blessed be my son by the Lord. And he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, I dedicate the silver to the Lord from my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image. Now, therefore, I will restore it to you. So when he restored the money to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave it to the silversmith, who made it into a carved image and a metal image. And it was in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod, and household gods, and he ordained one of his sons who became his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now there was a young man of Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn where he could find a place. And as he sojourned, as he journeyed, he came to the hill country of Ephraim and to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, where do you come from? And he said to him, I am a Levite of Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to sojourn where I may find a place. And Micah said to him, stay with me, and be to me a father and a priest, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, and a suit of clothes, and your living. And the Levite went in. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. And Micah ordained the Levite, and the young man became his priest, and was in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will prosper me, because I have a Levite as a priest. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this morning and this time that you have called your people to be together. And as we worship you this morning, I pray that our hearts would be in the right place. And Father, we've just read a passage that is so filled with idolatry that it ought to make us sick as we consider it. And Lord, I pray that as we think about this morning, that if any of us here this morning have any sorts of idols in our lives, that you would reveal that to us, that you would show us those idols that we build or that others put in our way, and that you would also give us the strength through Jesus to tear those idols down and to be done with them. Help us, Father, to be true worshipers of yours. Help us not to be happy with the things that we create that are simply substitutes for you and for all the fullness that you offer to us. Lord, may we be true servants of yours. May we be true priests, living out the calling that you have given to us through Jesus and because of him. May we turn aside from all sin, from all encumbrances, and from all idols. May we turn to you at all times and in every way. May we look only to your Son and follow him as he leads us closer and closer to you. And it's in his name that we pray. Amen. These last five chapters in Judges are going to give us a picture of what happens when there is no king, when there is no central authority that people can look to determine right from wrong and to say, this is the way of God and this isn't. We're going to find out how society can break down. Maybe we've experienced this in our own lives. I remember reading a story a little while ago about some town that was somewhere that was kind of situated in between a few different jurisdictions. And as a result, when something came up in the town, nobody was really sure which police should respond. And so it would often happen that when something would be called in, it would take hours for anybody to show up that would have anything, any police that could do something about it, because one department didn't want to go because they didn't think it was their jurisdiction, and another department assumed that somebody else would go because they thought it was their jurisdiction. And so as a result, they were noticing an increase in kind of small crime. Nothing big and nothing what we would consider to be major, but a lot of smaller crimes were happening. A lot of car break-ins, a lot of house break-ins, a lot of assaults and things like that, because they knew, people came to know that it didn't matter what we do, nobody's going to respond anytime. And it's because there was nobody that they could count on or look to respond quickly at the moment. There was no central authority that they could look at. One time when I was in college, we went to a class and the professor wasn't there. And he had left some note of some kind that an administrator brought in. And he told us that we all knew what we should do in the class and that we should find a way to get through the class and cover the material. And so he expected us to actually conduct the class as though he were not there. Of course, we all left. That's what happens when there's nobody there that can take charge. It can say, this is the way it is, and this is what's going to happen with Israel. When there are no more judges, and when the text tells us clearly four different times in chapters 17 through 21 that there is no king and everyone does what is right in their own eyes, we're going to see what happens when people stop looking to God to rule over them. And these are people at this point, quite frankly, without excuse. These are people that have lived through hundreds of years of being ruled at times by judges, who were raised up by God's grace in response to their cries of oppression. So that when they went out and messed up their own situation by discounting and ignoring the goodness of God in previously rescuing them, and they cast it all away, and God still came through for them, although by the time of Jephthah and Samson, he begins to question them from time to time about why he should reach down and save them, but he's always come through for them. But after Samson, no more judges arise until Samuel. And there's this block of time that exists where the people are, frankly, fending for themselves. But they've earned it this time, because they've shunned God so much that perhaps, as we read about here in the end of the book of Judges, God is giving them the opportunity to make it work for themselves the way they've appeared to want things to be all along. And so we start the story with this individual named Micah, whose name actually has something to do with hearing God. And yet his concern at the beginning of this event is something to do with silver. His mom's been crying about a lot of silver that was lost, He's been holding on to it. He hasn't said anything at the beginning here. She's calling down curses about whatever happened to this silver, and he's probably sitting in his room in the back of the house laughing about it because he knows he has it. Finally, he admits it to her. He says, I'm the one that took the silver. I'm the one that has the money. And she says, blessed be my son by the Lord. She's calling out God's favor now because he admits to stealing the money. There's a lot of irony in this chapter because this is what they've come down to. And dare I say that when we find our lives in turmoil, that we might also find a lot of irony happening because there's a lot of opportunities that we could look back at that time and say, well, if only we had done this or turned that way instead of turning this way, maybe we would find the favor of God instead of the chaos that we find ourselves descended into. Many times our lives spiral down. We wonder how we got there, but if we're objective about it, we can look back and say, this happened and this happened and this happened, and we see ourselves clearly in hindsight descending a staircase rather than walking up it. And that's the way it is with these people. And so Micah gives the money back. And then she consecrates the money to the Lord and gives it back to Micah. And in her mind, the consecration to the Lord means I'm going to give him this money back so he can go out and build an idol. The last thing that God would want. If she knew anything about God, and if she knew anything about the Ten Commandments that would have been given by this time, she would know that God does not want a carved image. God has no interest in an idol. And yet she says to him, I dedicate the silver to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a metal image. She's going to blaspheme the Lord with the money, while at the same time thinking that she's honoring the Lord. This is how bad it's become. And so Micah creates this idol. He makes another idol. He sets it up in his house. And when we read this idea about the house of Micah, we should be thinking more in terms of a priesthood of Micah. This is a dynasty he's trying to create. He's trying to create a priesthood around himself. And so he ordains one of his own sons. He goes completely outside of the Mosaic law here to appoint his own son to be a priest in his house. Why is he doing all this? We find out later at the end of the chapter here that he thinks that he's going to gain access to the Lord. He thinks he's going to get some sort of special privilege from the Lord because he is a priest. But he doesn't yet have a Levite priest, and that's solved by this individual that just happens to be traveling through. And he's coming through, he's a Levite, so he's a priest. He's looking for a job. He's looking for a place to live. He doesn't have anything. And so this man, Micah, realizes that he can manipulate this individual. He can manipulate this priest and give him a place to live. And so they have this discussion and they talk through things. And he agrees to hire on as a priest. And now Micah brings a hired priest into his household. Someone that's going to be working for him. He's not simply providing material support for a priest to go about doing the work of God. He hires the priest to be his own household priest. And the priest agrees. And that's when we read at the end of the chapter in verse 13 where Micah says, now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest. Big time problem. We find this individual trying to manipulate God. First, by building an image, by creating an idol that he's going to install and he's going to worship the idol. He may think he's worshiping God, but at best he's worshiping God through the idol. And that's going to be his first problem. The second problem is he thinks he can guarantee God's grace towards him or God's good favor towards him because now he doesn't just have any priest. He's improved from ordaining his own son to having a legitimate Levitical priest working for him in his house, if you will, in the temple that he built, at the altar that he built, with the idol that he built. He now has a so-called legitimate Levitical priest officiating on his behalf. And this is what it's come to in Israel. This is what it has degenerated to in Israel. Hired priests serving at false altars with carved images. And then it gets worse. The tribe of Dan comes along. And they're looking for a place to live. Now, what in the world would a tribe be doing at this stage looking for a place to live? But if you remember back to chapter 1, as Judges was describing the way that after the conquest, they were trying to clear out some of the people that had been left behind, maybe some of the people that had come back after being driven out that were hoping that maybe that wave has passed through and we can go back and reclaim something from our house. Maybe we can take up residence again. And so Israel was going through on this clearing out mission, trying to drive everybody out. And Judah was doing really well, but then we start to see that some of the other tribes failed at this. And they made deliberate choices to allow some of the people to continue to live in the land. And it got so bad that when the tribe of Dan went in to clear some people out, that they themselves were actually driven out away from the land that they should have inherited. And so at this stage of the game, we still have the tribe of Dan, the people of God, in the form of the tribe of Dan, who had land promised to them, and they're homeless. They haven't occupied the land yet. Because of the sin of Israel, they were driven away. Rather than driving out the people, they themselves were driven out in their attempt to take over the land. And so they're stumbling around. And they hear about this land that they might be able to take over. And so what they do is they send a group of 5 guys to go explore. And these guys are acting like the spies that went into the promised land. But there's not 12, there's only 5. Because they're not even close to being complete in this. They're not even close to doing God's will. God's will would have been for them to settle in the land that God wanted them to be in. But they're out searching. They're looking for anywhere they can go. Somehow, they come across the house of Micah. And they hear this priest inside, this Levitical priest, and somehow they know him. And so they start to talk to him, and they want to know from this priest, are they going to be successful? And what's interesting, and this is in chapter 18, and I would encourage you to read this later on today for yourself. But what's interesting is that when they are discussing with the priest, is God going to grant us mercy in this? Is God going to enable us to be successful in going against this land? The priest simply says, yeah, God's going to be with you. And there's no indication that he did anything of a religious nature to even communicate with God or ask him a question about it. Now, it's possible that he did. But I think that with the context of what's happening here in Judges, that he just freelanced and spoke for himself. He doesn't care about these guys. Remember, he's a hired priest. There's only one person he has to be accountable to. And these guys roll in from the tribe of Dan. They want to know, is God going to be with us? Sure he is. Now I have some other things to do. But the tribe of Dan goes out and they come back. And unlike the 10 spies that went into the promised land and came back, and 12 spies, 10 of them said that, no, we're not going to be able to do this. And 2 of them said, sure we can. All 5 of these guys come back and say, yeah, we can do this. So they go into the land. And they take it over. But they go back to the priest. And now they ask the priest that was with Micah, and they say to him, will you come with us and be our priest? And now they've got this strong force. I think it said maybe 600 or 800 fighters in the tribe. So this is a fairly large-sized group. And they're going to this priest, and I think he looks at the numbers, and he looks at the situation he has here, and he looks at the lack of guys that can support him. If he says no, and he says, yeah, I'm going to go with you guys. And so he leaves his job with Micah, and he goes off to be with the tribe of Dan. Micah's upset about that, and he tries to stop it, but he can't. I'm going to come back to something he says a little bit later. But the tribe of Dan goes, they take over the land, they take this priest, they install him, and you know what the priest did? He brings along with him the idols, and he sets them up. And at the end of chapter 18, I'm just going to read this, starting in verse 27. The people of Dan took what Micah had made and the priest who belonged to him, and they came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. Okay, violence. They went to a people quiet and unsuspecting, struck them with the edge of the sword, burned the city with fire. And there was no deliverer because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. Then in verse 29, they named the city Dan after the name of Dan, their ancestor, who was born to Israel, but the name of the city was Laish at first. And now in verse 30, and the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves. They set up the carved image for themselves, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, Jonathan, the grandson of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up Micah's carved image that he made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. So we have the tribe of Dan now taking advantage of people in Moses' lineage to practice false worship with idols. That's what these guys have come to. But the writer of the book of Judges explains all of this to us. And if we look back at chapter 17, verse 6, it becomes clear what's happening when it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. There was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's in chapter 17, verse 6, but we would read the same sentences in chapter 18, verse 1, in chapter 19, verse 1, and at the end of the book in chapter 21, verse 25. This is what happens when we let God out of our lives and when we have to fill that gap or that vacancy with some kind of an idol. It's the problem that happens when we create idols for our own lives. It's what happens when we think that we can improvise on the things that God has given to us. It's what happens when we think that we can work around what God has done. It's what happens when we think that we can use the things that God has given us to gain his favor in a special way. If we look at chapter 17, verse 13, the very end of that chapter, we see Micah saying, now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest. And he thinks that because he's brought on a Levite to be his household priest, even though that Levite is working as a hired priest, and he's working with a non-sanctioned altar in a house that was built by someone looking to earn God's favor outside of the system that God created, and he's working with an idol. But Micah thinks that somehow he can gain God's favor. He's working with a form of what we might even consider to be magic. That if he can just do the right thing, if he can run the right formula, if he can manipulate God in the right way, then he's going to trick God or force God to give him everything he wants. And he's so far outside of the system that God has given them that it doesn't even make sense to us when we start trying to line up the pieces. But have we ever found ourselves in a similar situation? Have we ever found ourselves doing anything that we can to try to manipulate God in our favor? And I don't mean at this point that even necessarily that we're actively doing this. Maybe subconsciously we're doing it and we realize it after the fact. And I don't mean to suggest that we're doing this out of ill will. Sometimes we just degenerate and our lives spiral out of control so much that we find ourselves doing the same things. Creating an idol, building an altar, bringing other people in to help us, bringing other people down, feeling as though we have God's grace or we have access to God's grace because we have unlocked the lock, if you will. We found the magic key to make God give us everything that we want. We found the money to fit the vending machine so that we can hit the button for what we want and get it delivered to us instantly. We've gained God's favor because we've figured him out. That's what Micah thought he had. It's what we know he didn't have because we've got this larger picture here. But here he is running around thinking, I've got God in a box. I've got him under control. I've tamed him. I've figured him out. I can do whatever I want. And if I can't, this guy, the Levitical priest, can. And that's why he's so sure of himself at the end. And he's not even looking at this from a spiritual point of view. He's not looking at spiritual growth. He's not looking at restoring the name of the Lord among Israel. He's not looking at bringing others to God. He's not looking at being this light to the nation that God wanted Israel so badly to be. He's looking at prospering. What can I get from this deal? What can I get from this arrangement? And I'm going to set things up on my end to ensure that God delivers on his end. And why do you think he's so upset when the tribe of Dan comes along and steals his priest away? Because they're messing with his system. Because he filled all the gaps, lined everything up. And here comes these bullies that come in, and they take it away from him. And now he's mad because he had a way to prosper. He had it guaranteed to him, in his own mind at least, and now it was taken away. And we see these Danites from the tribe of Dan doing the same thing. Let's take this priest. He's got a little bit of experience. Let's take his idols because obviously they're working. And this guy told us that God's going to enable us to be successful, and he was right, and let's take them. And even though we know what God has taught, let us set up an idol where we are. And let's bring Moses' grandson in and have him lead us with the idol. And it's a joke. We see in chapter 17, verse 3, more of the same. When the money is restored by Micah to his mother, she gives the money back to him after she dedicates it to the Lord so that he can make a carved image and a metal image. See, here's the problem. We're not even looking at this point at people who now are worshiping a false god. Okay, previously in Judges, that was the problem. They would be oppressed by the people. They would turn away from God to a false god among other nations. Then they would be oppressed by those nations. They'd have to call out to the true God. But now we're looking at not the false worship of a false god, but the false worship of the true God. See, they brought it closer to home now. They're not just falsely worshiping a God who doesn't exist. They're falsely worshiping the one God, true God, who does exist by building an idol. They know better, but they continue to do this. They continue to walk down the street. Maybe sometimes we find ourselves doing this. Maybe sometimes in our lives we find ourselves looking any which way to find a false god or an idol or some system or some explanation or some set of facts from the Bible or some list of commands that if only we could keep these things, if only we could do all of these things, if only we could find a way through this, we can manipulate God into giving us what we want. I wonder sometimes if maybe we find our worship even becoming a matter of convenience for us. It's one of those keys that we put into the lock that when we turn it, it unlocks that and brings us benefits from God. How many times do we find ourselves rolling out of bed on Sunday morning, begrudging going to worship, but feeling as though if we don't, maybe something bad's going to happen to me. And I'm going to have that X beside my name with God rather than the check mark. And I need that check mark because I have too many X's. And so we find ourselves trying to manipulate God through the things that we do. When what God really wants is a people who will worship him in sincerity, in genuineness, and in truth. The worst of this is in chapter 18. The absolute worst of this. And it's down around verse 24. This is in the conflict between Micah and the tribe of Dan. And this is at the height of when the tribe of Dan is taking the priest from Micah and they're taking the idols. And this is really how bad it is. And if we look at our own lives, we can see that we probably constructed some things like this too, that if somebody tried to take it from us, we would fight just as hard as Micah does to hold on to these things. But in verse 24, Micah is speaking to the representatives from the tribe of Dan. And he's talking to them about their taking of his priest and his stuff. And he says, "You take my gods that I made and the priest and go away, and what have I left?" Look at what he is saying here. You take my gods that I made. He's talking about the things that he created that he thinks he can control. And now he's finding out that the things that he created, that he thinks he can control, he can't control at all. Because all it takes is a bully or a superior force to come in and take them from him. The gods that he made are being passed around by whoever's stronger that day. And he says, "You take the gods that I made, and what do I have left?" Have we ever reduced our lives to that? that if we look out and we built up something for ourselves and it starts to crumble beneath us and we say, if that falls, I don't know what I have left. Because we're looking at the idol or the altar of our own construction and not the true God who sustains us and establishes us and gives us the strength to stand even when we stumble and struggle. That is exactly what we see with Micah. You take my gods, and why would we even want gods that we can make? A god that we can make is not a god at all. Because that means that we would be the creator and not the created. But we know that we are called to submit to our creator. And when we form and make gods to do our own bidding, we need to realize how far away we are from God at that point. And we need to give that idol up. And in some cases, we need to tear it down. And in other cases, we need to ask some other people to come in with sledgehammers and help us take that down. There will be no idol. There will be no altar. There will be no temple that we can build that will house the presence of the Lord and that will stand firm. All of it will be torn down. All of it will be destroyed. We may think we have something foolproof at the time, but if our allegiance is not to the true God and to Him alone, at some point, everything will fall apart. And at that point that it falls apart, how dare we blame the Lord for that? Because it was our own idol that fell apart. And when we trust God, and when we depend on Him, and when we acknowledge the promises that He has made to us, and we put our hope in Him, and we live for Him, and we cast aside everything else, we will never be disappointed. Our disappointment comes when we expect something from God. Our disappointment comes when we build something else up and call it God, and then it crumbles beneath us. But when our hope, when our lives lie in the truth that God is, and everything that He has promised for us, and the deliverance that He has given to us, we will never go wrong. We need to give up our idols. Let them go. Trash them. Destroy them. Tear them down. Ask others to help us if that's going to be what it takes. Don't ever be afraid to ask somebody to help you. Draw closer to God. There is nothing to be ashamed with about that. And when we see that one of the problems in Judges was that there was no king, and in those days when there was no king, everybody did what was right in their own eyes, that is a major clue to us that we do have a king today. And we have a king who sits at the right hand of God, who has accomplished so much for us and has left us some instructions. He's left us a plan. He's given to us so many good things. And when we read that warning in Judges, it is a major clue to us to get serious about the fact that we need to submit to our King. Not look past the things that He's done for us and not look past the system that He has created for us that revolves around and goes through His Son, Jesus. God is preparing, has prepared the way for us. And it's through Jesus. He is our King. We need to give up our idols. We need to submit to our King. We need to stop being like those who lived in this time of Judges, who had no king. They did what was right in their own eyes. We have a King. We can still do what's right in our own eyes, but we'll have the same problems that they had in Judges, and not just in Judges, but throughout the whole Bible when we find examples of people who choose to live outside the authority of the King. He is our King. Give up our idols and submit to Him. If you're here this morning and need to turn your life over to God, if you need to submit to your King, if you need to change your life, we'd encourage you to let us know by coming forward as we stand and sing our song.